Welcome to Woolful, a podcast for fiber folk. I'm excited to share with you some incredible people I've had the opportunity to talk to in this community we love so much. From shearers and shepherds to knitters and shop owners, here's where you get to listen to a little part of their fiber journey.
I want to thank our sponsor for this week's episode. Taproot Magazine is a quarterly print magazine full of delightful stories and photos written by and for people living fuller and digging deeper. Each issue is created around a subtle theme, featuring amazing recipes, crafts, and tales, all with the intention of inspiring people who are interested in deepening their connections to their families, communities, and themselves as they strive to live locally and closer to the ground. The content in each issue consistently blows me away. It is fulfilling and inspiring. The most recent issue, Weave, features a collection of wonderful finds as we close out winter and step into spring. With lessons in growing cosmos, paleo and homemade bitters recipes, Wendell Berry and Tasha Tudor essays, and a collection of knitting and crochet how-tos. There is so much goodness in each issue. You can visit Taproot Magazine online at taprootmag.com and on Instagram at taprootmag. Over the past few years, I've had the pleasure of getting to know Matt and Christina of Greenbow Farm, first discovering their yarn, visiting their farm, and following their incredible journey on Instagram. This first-generation family-run farm is an inspiration that with hard work, sacrifice, gumption, drive, and business savvy, you can achieve your farm dreams. They are doing it, creating a living on and from their farm. I hope you'll take some time to visit their site, Instagram, and shop. And if you're in the Seattle area, you can find them at the West Seattle Farmers Market every Sunday. Visit greenbowfarm.com and find them on Instagram at Greenbow Farm. And with that, here's Matt and Christina.
I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but my grandparents had a farm outside of Kansas City, Missouri, in Pleasant Hill, Missouri. And I spent pretty much every summer there from the time I was a baby until I was 13, 14. And I've always had really good memories of farming. They didn't have that many animals by the time I was older, but they still grew some of their own fruits and vegetables. And the neighbor had cows that would come to the fence and we would feed it apples from the crabapple tree. And being Missouri, you know, there was tons of fields full of corn. And we would spend a lot of time playing hide and seek in the corn. When we started sort of playing around with the idea of farming, that was my impetus, besides the fact that Matthew and I both have a strong connection to cooking food and wanting to grow our own food.
From about the time I was in high school and through college, I worked as a chef, kind of worked my way up through the ranks there. And I really enjoyed cooking. I really enjoyed preparing food for people. It was a really wonderful connection and seeing people come and, week after week and have that connection with people and the people that are serving them the food, people that are preparing them the food. It was really kind of a rewarding sense of community. And of course, restaurant life is different from farm life in big, vast ways. But I didn't go straight from that to farming. I actually left that I went to college and was where I met Christina. And I had a career in the arts for about 15 years in Seattle doing art preparation, installing shows, working with collectors, that sort of thing. And when that career kind of came to an end kind of came to a point where I did not want to go on with it any longer, we were looking for something to do. We wanted to kind of get away, from the city a bit, have a little more room and build something of our own. And it was that connection to food that I really was really valuable to me, and being able to feed families and that sort of thing. So of that came farming, which was something that which was a way that I wanted to connect with existence, I guess, my own existence and everybody else's existence a little bit more, to kind of understand where our resources come from, the resources that we take for granted every day. Somewhere in there, we decided we were going to get some sheep. And after having sheep for a while, we decided we were going to invest in producing some small farm yarns from our Icelandic sheep. And that was something that was always kind of interesting to me. I think it took us a year to get around to it, and there are two or three shearings in there. and I had taught myself to knit or learned to knit before we started farming. And that was just kind of a way to, again, kind of connect with our resources and learn more about natural fibers. Natural fibers kind of disappeared from our consumer's plate, I guess, and you know, the value of natural fibers and things like that, and then be able to make something of your own. So I've always been fairly crafty. You know, I've done woodworking and all kinds of different things. You know, fixed my own vehicles and you know, I've been fairly resourceful. And so knitting was kind of a way to you know, get to that element of, you know, existence and consuming. It was a process I discovered before we started a farm, before we got sheep, and before we started making our own yarn.
Tell me a little bit more about maybe some of the creative aspects of growing up, or people that were influential in both your lives that inspired you in either agriculture or fiber.
For me, I think it was really going to art school. Going to art school was a time when, you know, it was just a lot about asking questions and feeling like you could learn, you could teach yourself how to do anything. And so when we came to the idea of becoming farmers, it didn't seem that ludicrous that we could teach ourselves to be farmers, and specifically farmers that, you know, direct marketed our food and our fiber, because, you know, we could wear many hats. We have many different skills, you know, photography, writing. Matt's great at carpentry, and he's great with customers. He's great with talking with customers. My background at PCC Natural Markets was all about learning from customers in the community about why they're interested in natural and organic food. So teaching them about things that I knew and them teaching me, and farming felt like the perfect way to keep extending that kind of community, but even have a stronger connection to them because you're providing them with food and fiber and really the things that I enjoyed as being an artist, like seeing other people create and talking about that. I've seen that in our life as farmers. We get to see the food, especially through social media. We get to see the food that people create with our farm food. We get to see the things that people make with our yarn and our wool batting. And we've started to be able to have some special relationships with people because of those. So to me, it's an extension of that art community and that food community that I was a part of for, you know, almost 20 years.
And I think for me, there was a period in my life when I was exposed to a man who sort of took me under his arm and took me out into the woods, and we cut Christmas trees and we cut firewood and we went hunting and we, you know, brought home deer and we went to farms and we picked apples and we picked pears and we picked, you know, we spent a lot of time outdoors and we spent a lot of time exploring resources. And he was also a tremendous cook. He was probably the first real cook in that I got to know in my life. And I was about, you know, 10 or 11 years old or something like that. And he was fairly influential on me for a number of years before he passed away in 1995. And but he made a big impression on me, and you know, kind of made that connection with existence, you know, where your resources come from, and being able to get your own resources and you know, those basic necessities of life that were just sort of, you know, I think sort of forgotten in modern day life. And you know, having that connection to the land and everything is sort of what brought me around to wanting to become a farmer and believing that I could become a farmer.
Fast forward to your life in West Seattle. Tell me a little bit about your life there and how Greenbow, or, you know, moving to a farm came to be.
Well, we got a handful of chickens 1 year, and I think that was kind of the beginning and the end there. Next thing you know, I mean, we're just thrilled to death that we have these little critters running around our yard producing eggs for us. So we'd had, you know, dogs and things like that, but that's, you know, having a livestock animal was really kind of rewarding. And, we always gardened and things. So it just sort of, it kind of snowballed from there. I think I was at a point in my, career in the arts where, you know, I either had to, find a whole nother career altogether, or I'd have to probably take a pay cut and move halfway across the country. And neither one of those was all that appealing to find another career in the arts. So starting your own business seemed reasonable. And, with our growing family and everything, that seemed like an attractive thing to do, was get some land and start a farm and try to live closer to home. I think it was just time for a change. We wanted to get out of the city. We wanted to have something to call our own, and we wanted to produce something for other people. And we wanted to, food was always a big part of our lives. So we always cooked at home and prepared all of our own meals and things like that.
One of the moments that stands out for me was we had a rooster in our backyard in West Seattle, and technically in the city you're not supposed to have roosters. And we decided, if we're going to have chickens, we are going to be able to be comfortable with butchering them if need be. So we decided to butcher our rooster one day, no plucker or anything. We're doing it all by hand. And we, pulled out our coq au vin recipe, and we made this meal, and we fed our friends with it. And it just, the whole process, the killing wasn't easy, but it was one of those things, like, if I'm going to eat meat, this, I really appreciate knowing exactly where it came from and what kind of life that it lived. And then to see that full cycle, to be able to prepare a meal that was delicious and nourishing to not just only our family, but our friends. That was one of those moments for me where I was like, I would love to do this for more people. And really we started off with much smaller, ambitions, more of a homestead. But when we saw land that we could, raise more animals on, we just, took the leap. And our sheep were sort of our gateway animal as far as becoming, sort of feel like real farmers, or our first ruminants, our first time dealing with larger animals that, the shearing was a big learning curve. It's definitely much different than our life in West Seattle. We have, though, found the community here the way we found community in West Seattle, through people that are interested in our farm, people that come out and volunteer and make themselves a part of what we're doing.
Taking a step back to this decision to move to Ellensburg and find this farm, take me on a little bit of the journey of finding that farm and establishing yourself there.
Well, we really didn't know what we were doing, to be quite honest. We didn't really know what we were looking for. We knew we didn't really want to do a lot of row crop production, so we weren't really looking for that kind of farm. We wanted to find something that would be good for grazing pastures. And after kind of listening to a lot of pasture regeneration talks and people that are in that business, Alan Savory and all these things, healing the land, I think we kind of had in our mind to go and find the worst piece of ground we possibly could. So we succeeded in that pretty well. But then we were also able to turn it around. So the property we bought is kind of – It's agricultural land. It's zoned for agricultural land, and it was part of a large ranch before. But it's agricultural value is pretty small, especially the smaller acreage you get. So it was fairly rocky and weedy and windy, and it still is. But we were able to turn it around, and through rotational grazing, through that multi-species rotational grazing, and because we graze more than just sheep and chickens. We now have cattle and pigs and things like that. But we installed a sprinkler system, and we did practice rotational grazing. We were able to take this sort of, pretty rough ground and turn it around. And we've done a pretty good job of that. We can support many more head of livestock than we used to. We probably increased our forage production by four times, fourfold, just through that rotational grazing and irrigation. During that time, we also had one of the most severe droughts the state's ever had, in living memory anyway, and we lost irrigation water, and that was a kind of a major setback in our third year of farming here. And because of where we are, where we're at, we're on junior water rights and things like that. We don't have that sort of ability or you know, privilege, I guess, to have a senior water right where that allows you to take water. You're the last people with water in a drought year. And then we invested in a no-till drill through a grant program. We invested in a no-till drill that allowed us to additionally increase forage production on this piece of land. And after all of those decisions were made, and after us, you know, looking around for a year or so, a year and a half, we were looked around for a new farm. You know, is this a possibility? Should we relocate? Because we're going to have to expand to be able to make a living here. I think it was last fall that we decided that we're just going to have to make a go of it where we're at. And that was our intention all the way through the winter and into the spring. And as spring got started and we were really picking up momentum in spring production, this new farm came on the market. And it was something that we thought, well, we'll just go look at it and then we can put it out of our mind and be done with it and move forward. And when we got there, we realized it was about the most perfect situation that you could come by. And it had been a family farm for 100 years or more, and farmed by the same family. I think they were homesteaders of the land. And so we put in an offer, and we spent all summer trying to come up with the financing. And they and then in the end we were able to purchase it, which is a whole nother story. But so we just closed on it last week.
Congratulations. So when you look at moving to this farm and building the infrastructure and all that, what were some of the biggest challenges that you encountered aside from the water?
Topography wise, it is not a flat piece of ground. There's lots of different ravines. So the rotational grazing that we like to do, it's challenging in certain parts of the farm to move the animals at great lengths, because you're not just opening a paddock or a gate. And sometimes our Icelandic sheep can actually be the most challenging to move because they are a primitive breed and they don't flock the way a lot of sheep breeds do. So it's rocky, hard, very windy. We've had, you know, huge chicken tractors blown over in the wind. But with everything that we've done, we have seen a major difference with the rotational grazing. It is really, truly a regenerative type of farming. And when you see the results firsthand, you start to realize how much could be different if more people were farming this way.
Well, I think one of the biggest things for us is we were able to implement that rotational grazing and everything and the pasture regeneration and really kind of bring the fields back to life with desirable forages that the animals did really well on and gained well on and supported them well. And in addition to some other practices such as applying compost tea to the irrigation system and providing lots of free choice mineral for animals and just kind of letting the land take care of the animals, that was the biggest thing, or that was a very successful part of it. The part that we really failed at is that we thought we would come into this and be able to put up a lot of infrastructure, buildings and things like that. But it turned out there was just never any time in the day to be able to get those things done. And so we did very little, and we have very little infrastructure here other than the fencing and the irrigation systems. We structures and other things just never seemed to happen. There was just never any time or money to get it done. And that's something that the new farm kind of solves. There's lots of old buildings that just need some repair and things like that.
A question that I think you probably get asked a lot, and I know I get asked, and how did you learn all this? And was it just teach yourself? Was it just in the moment? Did you guys have mentors or people that you really were able to kind of talk to throughout the whole process?
Well, there's certainly nothing wrong with sidling up to people that know more than you do. We certainly have done that. We've taken advantage of exposing ourselves to people that are more experienced than us and taking a lot of different ideas from everybody. And there's no, you ask three farmers how to do something and you'll get six different answers. But, being able to take all that information and then sift through it and find what works for you has been pretty helpful. But also we've done a lot of conferences, workshops, YouTube has been an enormous resource. I mean, anything you need to do, and you just YouTube it, and you've got your answer. It's pretty amazing. Whether you're trying to repair a vehicle or solve some mysterious problem, I mean, somebody else out there has done it, and that's the great thing about that sort of internet resource, that social media resource. It's pretty wonderful that people are willing to share so much in our culture today. But I think it was just, you know, it was just kind of, maybe it was a lifetime of just being able to take on large projects or small projects at first and seeing them through and getting them accomplished and then moving on to the next thing. And so it seemed like maybe farming wasn't so crazy. And so we would just figure it out. And for the most part we have, but you know, I mean, you're certainly learning new things every day.
Yeah. I think a lot of it we did, you know, just by trial and figuring out each time how we could do it better, particularly moving animals. It's one of those things, you know, each animal is different. The different breeds have different ways, you know, needs and temperaments, and figuring out the best ways that we could do it for, you know, low stress for everybody, for the animals and the farmers involved moving. And it's really one of those intuitive things. You have to do it. You have to be standing out there, trying it, figuring out how you need to move your body in a way that will move them in the right direction, and the sounds you need to make, and doing it just over and over and over again.
Tell me a little bit about both of your guys' roles on the farm.
I do a little bit of everything, but not a lot of one thing. Primarily do the marketing through social media, on Instagram and Facebook. And then I do some basic, chores whenever needed. Primarily, I'm taking care of my three sons most of the day. And then most of it is just Matt and I talking a lot, talking about logistics, talking about managing farm employees, managing what we're going to do with the animals next, what our next season is like. A lot of it is just he and I talking a lot.
Well, it's hard to piece what I do. You know, I manage the animals. I kind of set the rotation schedules. I do these sort of things. I think that in a way, and us acquiring this new farm and relocating to this new farm, which we're in the process of now, is something that, it's part of our growing. So, I think we grew a little faster, or we got a little more attention than we thought we would. We just weren't really ready for the rate at which we grew, at which our demand grew, and the amount of product we had to produce to be able to support the farm is growing quite a bit. So we have employees. We're trying to produce enough to have more employees and get those employees into kind of plugged into particular roles. And then I'm going to actually be spending a little more time administering the business and marketing and doing these sort of things and less of the day-to-day chores. And it's just kind of the way, even though I'd kind of rather be doing the day-to-day chores, I think it's just sort of the way that things have to go, because we're producing, we have 15 or 20 different products or examples of things that we sell. And some of those products have completely different audiences. For example, you know, our pasture raised grass-fed finished beef and our pasture raised eggs and our pasture raised chickens and all those things have a different audience than like our yarn customers or our soap customers. So we're trying to be a very diversified farm and trying to use everything that we produce on the farm, but it's also kind of created this situation where we're spread pretty thin trying to satisfy all those things versus if we were just producing beef or fiber or something like that. So day to day, I try to do as much as I can, but I always go to bed with a longer list, to-do list than I woke up with. So
it is pretty fun though, seeing customers if they have a basket of produce and they have our eggs, maybe some of our meat, and then a little skein of yarn stuffed in there too. So, you know, it's not that we are marketing them completely, or different people are buying them sometimes. It's a different, you know, our yarn isn't the same kind of yarn that you pick up in most of the local yarn stores. So it does help to be able to talk to people in person, you know, to have them be able to look at it and why we produce it, because, you know, that is a huge part of the story too.
So tell me a little bit about all the animals and products that you guys have, because you guys, I know that you...
We have a lot, yeah. Yeah, we just started with some chickens and a very, very small flock of sheep, 13 Icelandic sheep and one ram. And the Icelandic sheep really gave us the confidence to add on the Scottish Highland cattle.
We knew we couldn't really make much of a living on just sheep, we wanted to get that multi-species grazing going on. And so, you know, at first, like Christina said, we started with some laying hens, and we started with the sheep. I think we had about 12 ewe lambs. And then we just kind of moved forward. And I think the next season we added some meat chickens. And then by that fall, we bought a small herd of Scottish Highland cattle, which were a good resource for us because they browse as much as they graze, meaning they browse a wide variety of forages, broadleaf plants and things like that, in addition to grazing, which is considered more just a grass consumption. And so do the Icelandic sheep. So this really helped solve a lot of our weed problems. And then chickens, you know, having like a flock of 500 laying hens really can help your weed situation too, by just parking them on weedier areas, and they come out and they either destroy the plants or they destroy the plants and they eat the seeds that the weeds are dropping on the ground. So you get more of a perennial grass clover mix, you know, when you're done. But we, through all that, we were able to manage and market all of our lamb. You know, our demand for beef is higher than we can meet, and then we added pork recently too, and that was something that we decided to do. We found a really good feed source that we liked, and we thought, well, you know, we should try pork. And then we also pasture them with temporary electric netting, and we move that once a week, and move the pigs. And something we've also used a no-till drill for is we planted about 2 acres of like black oil sunflowers, peas, mango beets. I think there's some oats in there too, and we would graze them through that standing forage, and they would just, after a week, they would just knock it all down and have consumed most of it. And we would do that to kind of regenerate certain areas of pasture. They would do some rooting and things like that. So it's an area where maybe we wanted to change the forage that was in there, so we could go back in with a tractor and sort of grade out the ground. You'd have some exposed ground. You could replant it with a no-till drill and get some new forages growing in there, some more desirable stuff. So we'd use the pigs in that way. And then I already mentioned how we use the chickens and the sheep and the cattle to manage the weed production. And then another thing that we had was we had a lot of poor nutrients in our soil. So, you know, we're spending good money on things like chicken feed. And they produce from that chicken feed a really, you know, nutrient-dense manure. So being able to move them around pastures on a regular basis and be able to cover all the ground that we possibly can and park them on troubled areas longer and sort of manage it that way, we've increased our nutrient density in our soil quite a bit. Still has a long ways to go, but at our current place, we've increased the forage and the nutrient density a great deal just by managing those animals.
And one of the reasons we picked the Icelandic and the Scottish Highlands, besides that they both browse and graze, like Matt was talking about, is the Icelandics are also known for just sort of really easy lambing. And we have really been able to be almost completely hands off with lambing. And that was a decision we made because we had really young children and we knew that we wouldn't be up all night lambing with little kids. And so the other aspect of that is that they have a much smaller body. And so if you are raising them for meat, when you take them to a butcher, they have different kinds of cuts, much smaller, and really they're more expensive to produce meat-wise. So a huge part of it has been the education, like, why should somebody be interested in Icelandic lamb? How does it taste different? How is the way we raise them different? And part of the reason we got into the fiber and also selling the lamb skins was to make up for that, the higher cost of raising a smaller animal.
That's a great segue into talking a little bit more about the fiber aspect of your guys' business. And I know one thing that I love about what you guys are doing is that you really are setting an example and a model of, like, you can't just put all your eggs in one basket. You can't just depend financially on one or two things. Really, it's all the pieces that come together. And so what role does fiber play in your guys' business? And maybe tell me a little bit more about how, when you guys came to the decision to make your own yarn and how that came to be.
As far as making our own yarn, the thing about the Icelandics is that they need to be shorn twice a year. And in the early stages, we just, you know, we knew it had potential, but we didn't really have the capital or the audience to put any more investment into the wool. So we were just selling the fleeces raw. We'd take them to market in a bag or whatever, and we'd basically make back the shearing costs, and that's about it. But, you know, over time, we kind of learned that we had, and I think it was Christina that sort of insisted that we go and have some yarn made. And so, you know, we shopped around for a mill that would do Icelandic fiber and spin a lopi yarn for us. And we were able to find a really great mill, and they've worked with us every year. And we just produce a really wonderful yarn out of that fiber. And we usually select our fall shearing to go to yarn, and then we take our spring shearing, and we use that for various things. Well, we do dryer balls, which are most people are probably familiar with those, a felted wool ball that you use in the dryer instead of a dryer sheet. And those have been very popular. So that's you know, being able to reclaim use out of those, you know, kind of, I guess we'd say, agricultural byproducts, is just another path of revenue, which, you know, a small farm or any farm really is kind of needs. So
I just really wanted to see what it would look like. I was just, the Icelandics are beautiful, and we chose our first flock based on colors and sizes and health of the animals, of course, but really we wanted a wide variety of colors, and we've always kept that in mind when we're picking out a ram. And so I wanted to see what would happen. Like, could we get like a full rainbow of lopi yarn, from whites to grays, to heathers, to browns, to blacks. And I wanted to see what people could make with it. And so it's been really interesting. Both of us have had people in our lives pre-farming that we've been able to connect with again, about the fiber. My friend Rachel Marcotte, that I worked with at PCC Natural Markets for a long time, we were both union negotiators, and she left PCC at the same time that I did and went and started farming. And she's a farmer, artist, knitter, and she designed a hat for us that would work with our yarn. And Matt worked at Western Bridge. It's an art organization that was in Seattle for a long time. And we've had artists that he has worked with in the past that have connected with us and used our wool and yarn. Mandy Greer has used it in a lot of her site-specific pieces, and also she does a lot of weaving. And then Ruth True, who is a part of Western Bridge and started a newbie American-sourced store in Capitol Hill. She made this beautiful blanket. It's like all black, and it had this gray stripe with this beautiful detailing in it. And so it's been really fun to be able to share our farm with people from our past in that way, and see how much they value what we're creating on our farm. And so that's the part that's really exciting to me. And then working with new people too, like Chelsea Burkampus from she wrote the Wool Project ebook, and it was really great to see her highlighting all these different types of yarns from different sheeps and different breeds and different animals, and creating, you know, patterns specifically for different types of yarn. I mean, that was just such a beautifully put together book. And she made the Icelandic inspired slippers using some of our yarn. So we're trying to figure out where we go from here with it. You know, we're moving the farm. We're definitely going to be expanding our Scottish Highland herd. We're expanding our Icelandic herd a little bit. So, you know, we're never going to make a ton of yarn. So part of it is not necessarily creating more yarn, but what are the things we can do? And we have a local nonprofit art gallery that would like to help facilitate getting artists into farms to work on the farms, but also to be making art as a part of community projects. So I would like to bring artists that are interested in fiber onto our farm and see what, you know, kind of future projects we could come up with from that avenue.
You guys know how much I love your guys' yarn, and I have my own secret little stash that I've been hoarding. My favorite color is the rose blends, and you guys just did such a great job with that.
Yeah, we're excited. Every year we get different colors back to the mill because they're not dyed. Of course, they're all natural blends from the fleeces that come off the sheep in the fall. And that quality fiber is so much better the fall shearing because they've been on irrigated pasture and they're on good rich grass legume pasture and everything. So their fiber is quite a bit better. And I know that traditionally, you know, Icelandic sheep are, they're sort of turned out in Iceland anyway. They're just sort of turned out in, into the hills, and they forage around. They lick, lichen and seaweed and things down near the water. And I had some Icelandic nationals come by my farmer's market booth in Seattle. I guess it was a couple years ago, and they commented on how much softer the fiber is than what they're typically getting at home. And you know, that's primarily because of the irrigated pastures and the rich grass legume pastures, where they don't Icelandics are pretty robust. I mean, they can get by on very, very little forage, but ours are pretty spoiled, I suppose.
They're very spoiled.
But the so it's exciting to get the yarn back every year because the mill give them direction on what we want from it, and they kind of figure out what quantities they have after they sort it and what different colors they're going to get back. So every year we get a little bit more back, and every 2 years we replace our ram. So I think last year we had a white ram, and so some of our lambs are, we got more white colors and things like that. And then I think when we look for a new ram, we're going to look for another black ram because we got some very interesting colors from that combination.
We should talk about our mill, Morningstar Fiber. We have spent a long time building a relationship with them, and that is one of the biggest learning experiences going into farming. You think, well, I've raised this animal or I've grown this fruit or vegetable and it's just all done, but a huge part of our learning curve for meat in particular is, you know, finding a good WSDA or USDA processor and butcher that can work with you and really keep that quality through the entire process. And it's the same with fiber. There isn't, a ton of mills out there that are easy to work with, that can work in the time frame that you need, and that are willing to talk to you about the vision that you have and have the ability to create that. So we really appreciate the work we've done with them.
It was difficult for us to find a mill that could kind of handle our volume and our sort of turnaround needs and the Icelandic fiber. I guess most spinning machines can't handle that longer staple length, and the Icelandic fiber can be 8 to 10 inches in length, and they have the inner coat and outer coat, and it's that longer fiber that is kind of more of the issue. But it does, because of that longer fiber, you get that really kind of light twist, single ply, low ply, which is so nice to work with. And, it has that big chunky bouncy feel. And it's just been kind of a really great product for us. And we kind of just stick to that one product. But Morningstar has really worked with us and helped us kind of learn more about our process and overcome any issues so that we don't repeat things in the following year. And JC and his wife there are incredible people to work with, and they're very attentive to what we need as producers and marketers, and they've always kept a very good turnaround schedule for us. If we get the fiber to them on this day of the year, they'll get it back to us, you know, in 2 months, and that's sort of established, you know, months ahead of time. And it's always kind of a race to pull all that off and get it shipped and everything, get it washed and shipped off to them. But they've never let us down. And they actually went through a move, relocating their mill from Ohio to North Carolina, and still did a great job for us. It was pretty impressive.
That's great. Tell me how you guys came up with the name Greenbow.
Well, you know, actually that was kind of more Christina. I'm sorry, she had to go. But she sort of pressed us into it. And well, I think that her idea, the kids kept calling it the Green Farm because the house was green. And so that's how they referred to it. But then the idea of a green bow, you know, and using green wood to make it, you know, an archer's bow, has that snap and that resilience. And that's where the name really came from, is that you know, we intended to have be flexible and have that resilience that would keep us going from year to year.
I know just from over the last couple of years talking with you how much the markets play into your business, and there's so many people that want to start farms and want to make money off farms, and it's something that I know we've talked is really hard to do. And so share a little bit more about that side of the business, like what you guys have found successful for yourselves, which obviously is different for everyone because of location and demand, but and how the markets play into that.
Yeah, well, we actually drove around the Pacific Northwest trying to figure out where we would like to end up and what might work best for us. And you know, there's a lot of small farms like ours, direct market farms, on the, up and down the I-5 corridor in Washington State, and in places like Snoqualmie Valley and Skagit, and up in the islands, the San Juan Islands, and down, you know, in Olympia and things like that. Farms are within an hour or so of Seattle, and we recognize that that was a pretty important thing, being close to a good steady marketplace. And having that demand, and we, being from Seattle, knew about that demand. And Christina's experience at PCC Natural Foods, you know, she was well aware of that demand and seeing it firsthand. So in the end, we decided that we would look for property in Ellensburg, where we have been familiar with Ellensburg for 12 years, and we knew it was only a couple-hour drive to Seattle, and that we would be able to keep that customer base or develop a customer base in Seattle. And so, you know, probably wasn't our first choice, but I think it was the right choice. And we've really built a lot of nice community here. But starting a farm and you know, marketing your product was challenging at first. Of course, there's, you know, small farm food and raising food with the intensity that we do, with all the hands-on work that we do, and not selling our you know, kind of half-finished products into the commodity market. You know, if we were selling things into the commodity market, you know, and we're familiar with many of our neighbors that do that and everything. You know, they don't need to farm with the intensity that we do. They don't have to really focus on quality. If it's cattle, they're focused on the finished cattle weight because that's how they get paid. Our customers pay us on quality. We're selling quality over quantity. We're selling quality over, you know, what you might find in a grocery store. And we're also selling that connection to your farmer. And people really value that. But at the end of the day, and we talk about this a lot, is that it does just simply cost more to raise an animal from birth to finish based on you know, how many winters you have to carry that animal through. And it's that carrying that animal and having that, all that upfront cost is what really, you know, kind of generates a lot of extra expense to us. And then having to take that animal to a butcher, you know, pay for the butchering fees, and then bring it back and pay to freeze it and store it until it's sold, it creates a whole nother element of cost. But in the end, the consumer knows how that animal was raised through its whole life, how it was handled, how it, you know, died, and the experience and the nutrition that they're getting from that animal, which is something that I think a lot of people crave. So, you know, we're selling the story, but we're also selling the quality, and we really believe in that quality. And you have to believe. I mean, you have to know that you're doing a good job and be able to communicate that to your customers, to not only, you know, kind of make a living and sell that product, but it's just, you know, when you're that intensely involved and you're working 16 hours a day every day, you know, being having that love in your product and being able to convey that love to your customers is a really valuable aspect of what we do.
So let's talk a little bit about family, and unfortunately, I wish that Christina was here so she could share a little bit about her side as a mom and the farm. But tell me a little bit about raising your boys on the farm and what's that's been like and how it's changed from you from being in Seattle to being more rural.
Well, I think that we have a really wonderful community here with other families that go to school, and you know, our kids go to school together and stuff like that. We have a lot of community based around that, and that's been really wonderful. We have an amazing community here that is very supportive of us and helps us out whenever they can, and they step in and they're always invited and that sort of thing. So we do have that kind of community. I didn't suspect though that while I see my boys every day, how incredibly busy I am running a farm. And it almost seems like I spent more time with my kids before, but we all went in different directions, you know, and we didn't make our own schedules. And so now we can kind of, you know, we can find family time, we can do what we choose, but we do have some, you know, the farm does dictate some of the things that we have to do, a lot of the things that we have to do. And you know, being in a small farm where there isn't high profit margins or anything, you have to wear a lot of hats to work long days to get all those things done. So, you know, it definitely does impact family in that sense. In the other sense, we're always within arm's reach of each other. That's pretty valuable. I think Christina, you know, obviously, yep. She mentioned before that she does the vast majority of the childcare. And, you know, so she's driving them to school and picking them up from school and things like that. And that's just sort of part of our reality because we do live rurally. So we could drive them to a bus stop, but it's the opposite direction of school. You know, there's a lot of time on the road for that and away from the farm. So, you know, we kind of have, while the kids are young, we sort of have these different schedules, but our schedules change a little bit every year. And as kids are getting more independent, you know, our boys are 8, 6, and 4. So that's they still need us a lot, but this is starting to change and they're gaining a little more independence and things like that. They do a lot of work on the farm though, and they travel with me when we go to butchers, or I spend a lot of time on the road. As a matter of fact, I'm when we wrap this up, I'm getting in the truck and I'm driving to Spokane for a feed run. But we they'll come in the truck and drive with me, and we'll see all kinds of different things and experience all kinds of different things and spend time together that way. And then also they'll come out and do chores with us, and also help with a lot of those chores. So, and kind of build an understanding of how our farm works and what our farm does. And, you know, they're kids like all other kids. They kind of, you know, have interests in things that don't interest us, like Legos and toys and video games and the such. But we do try to get them outside and incorporate them into, you know, kind of our day-to-day routine, which is really nice because I think, you know, if we had stayed in the city and continue working in the city, the kids really wouldn't be part of our work life. So I think that's been a very valuable aspect. I think it's valuable for us and it's valuable for them to have that exposure.
In the aspect of family and friends and community, what have your friends and whatnot from over the years thought about the adventure that you guys have been on this last few years in farming?
Well, we've certainly had some naysayers, you know, but you kind of, through natural processes, sort of rid your life of those people. But we do have a lot of really wonderful friends, and the friends that we left behind in Seattle have continued to be incredibly supportive of us. And a lot, many of them are regular customers, and we see them on a weekly basis. And then the friends that we've made out here are also incredibly supportive. I mean, I think that everybody is thrilled to, you know, kind of have this in their lives, and they do, you know, because we do make it a part of the community, and part of the new farm is that we want to we have a space and buildings and things that we're going to open a farm store and have people come to the farm, which our current farm does not lend itself to. We're just too far out of the way. But the network that we have with people in our community, our friends and everything else, I think has been really valuable. And one thing that really kind of surprised me is that when we came out here, and this is kind of a big hat, you know, boot wearing town, cow town, you know, there's a lot of, you know, people have been doing the same thing for a long time. And, you know, they all kind of, you know, scoffed at us when we came to town and started farming the way we do. Not only do we not have any experience, but they just, you know, looked like we had no idea what we were doing. And so over the years, you know, kind of word spread and I've gotten a lot of, you know, nice compliments from people in town about the job that we're doing on our farm and the services we're providing and the living that we're making doing it. Most of our neighbors around here are raising cattle and raising hay and lots of acres. And they're selling, you know, many, many more acres than we're farming and selling it into commodity markets and then having to have outside jobs on top of that. And, you know, that's just part of how our food system works, which is really unfortunate that, you know, it's expected that if you're going to farm, you're going to farm, you know, 14, 16 hours a day and then have to have another income outside of that. It's just, I think it's a big... It's a big sinkhole in our economy, and farmers are getting older, and they're retiring, and there's no one coming in to replace them. I guess we could depend on imported foods, but the truth of the matter is, I mean, you know, that generation may have been pretty tough. They may have been willing to work, you know, all those hours, and then have outside income on top of that. But I don't see that being able to maintain, especially as younger generations start taking over farming, and hopefully they will take over farming. We're just going to have to get used to the idea that, you know, we spend a little more money on food like the rest of the world does. I think we spend, you know, for a developed nation, we spend the least amount of money on food of any other developed nation. And it's just kind of a, I think it's a bit of a failure in our society that farmers aren't making more money. They at least aren't be able to devote their, you know, 120 hours a week to one job and make a living at it. But to answer your question about friends and family and their support, we have an amazing social network of very supportive friends who are customers and customers who are now friends and it's just an incredible experience to have that amount of community around you and know that there's always somebody that you can reach out to. So we share the farm with the kids' school, and we have weekly or biweekly visits with the students to the farm, and we do different projects with them. And so they get to get their hands dirty and do different things. And I think that's been really, really valuable to not only us and our children, but to the community as a whole.
So obviously you guys just got this new farm, but tell me a little bit about your hopes, dreams, aspirations, and goals moving forward.
Well, I think, moving forward, what we'd really like to do is have a little more flexibility in our farm. I want to see our farm grow, probably about 3 or 4-fold, but I don't want to be a huge farm. I think that, you know, if we're going to do this, it's just going to take more people. You can't just put it all on one farm or a handful of farms. Moving forward, we'd like to, you know, kind of expand our production to meet demand. We're not meeting demand on a lot of our products, and then I think we want to incorporate some other aspects with the new farm. The new farm has so many possibilities. I think yesterday alone, we spent the day there working, myself and an employee, and we had a new employee show up who's going to be living on site there, and I think I had friends stop by 2 or 3 times that were just in route during the day and just came to check in or say hi or see what was going on. And we were basically just pushing around a lot of debris with the tractor and starting burn piles and things like that, which is always exciting. But, you know, we were really starting to just kind of get our hands dirty over there and clean up the property. And with all those visitors and things, I think we talked about everything from turning the old silo into an Airbnb to a custom, you know, dining place or something like that. But the other thing, we really want to work more with community, and we want to provide food, and we want to do some teaching courses or something. We plan to convert an old dairy barn there that has an old silo and all these things. And we convert the milking area into a commercial kitchen and be able to not only produce products there, but also, you know, host classes and things like that about preserving food and preparing food and these sorts of activities. And, you know, I think our overall goal is to, you know, not only just produce these wonderful products like the yarn and lambskins and everything else, but also to really get people back in their kitchens and cooking together as a family and that sort of thing. So that's always been a goal. And I see with the new farm, that's something that we might be able to focus on a little more intensely in addition to all the other things that we're planning to do. So being able to have, you know, sort of the it's kind of an economy of scale thing is what we're going for, is be able to size up to a point where, you know, we can produce enough income that we can take on these other little goals and not have one person spread so thin, but have the cash flow to support two or three people who are working on the farm and moving the goals forward.
I want to thank Taproot Magazine again for sponsoring this week's episode. With the natural, easygoing, and heartfelt focus of each issue, I find myself continuing to go back to it throughout the quarter, gaining a little something each time and looking forward to the upcoming issue. Make sure to check out the most recent issue weave, featuring the quill hat pattern from Andrea Mowry, knit in stone wool, three French hens toy pattern from Susan B. Anderson, knit in Bartlett Wool Company, and the Rose Mound scarf pattern from Ashlyn Holmes, crocheted in Quinns & Company. I highly recommend you visit taprootmag.com and renew or subscribe. This past November, we kicked off the year-long Woolful and Bishi Boosh knit-along. You can join any time this year by casting on one of Bishi Boosh's patterns or a project with one of their yarns. Visit bichesetbuches.com to be inspired and find your project kit or yarn. And visit woolful.com for more info on this knit-along. This week, we have another knit-along giveaway winner. Teresa L., you've won a $30 gift card to the Woolful Mercantile. Make sure to tag your knit-along photos on Instagram. The winners of last week's episode giveaway are Mary Beth, Dana, and Becky. You've each won a copy of Sylvia McFadden's Shawl Joy and a skein of Woolful's Cottage Yarn. Congratulations! This week's giveaway is sponsored by Taproot Magazine and Greenbow Farm, and they're giving away a two-year subscription to Taproot, two skeins of stone wool yarn to knit Andrea Mowry's hat patterns in, and two skeins of Greenbow Farm Lopi yarn. To enter, leave a comment on today's episode's blog post. The biggest of thanks to everyone involved in this week's episode, Taproot, Matt, and Christina. I hope you'll join me each week as we talk and learn from more fascinating fiber folk. For podcast notes and photos, visit woolful.com. If you're interested in being a part of this podcast, in one of our segments, or as an episode or giveaway sponsor, shoot me an email at hello@woolful.com. Have a wonderful week.